Upon reading this text a number of times, the words that came into my mind and stuck there were upward mobility. So I did a little Google search and came up with a number of articles having to do with upward mobility, but one especially caught my mind with the caption, "The Rise of Downward Mobility." It was in the Washington Post, and the first paragraph reads like this: "It's an axiom among Americans that each future generation will live better than its predecessor. New technologies, greater efficiencies, and a can-do spirit will reward us with higher standards of living. There might be periodic stumbles, but the long-term trajectory is up. And the people most guaranteed to enjoy this bountiful future are the children of today's upper middle class. They have all the advantages: attentive parents, good schools, a college education, and market job connections. That's the conventional wisdom. Ditch it. If you're an upper middle class parent, as I am," this is the article, "you must have noticed that the real world isn't playing according to script. Among many young Americans, there is a downward mobility. The children aren't achieving the way they and their parents expected. Even when they have, and many have, the gains could be eroded in the future. The trajectory is not inevitably up. Parents worry about their children's fate," end quote. A little bit later, there was an article that caught my attention too, in which there is among the younger people a desire for downward mobility. They've seen the lifestyle that their parents have lived and their parents having all the things, and they're choosing rather careers in adventure and careers in service. A kind of downward mobility, you might say. Much of what these articles try to measure in terms of downward or upper mobility have to do with economics. We applaud ambition, the desire to achieve, to climb the ladder, to get ahead and do better than the generation before us, whatever that means, usually in economic or social contexts. And for those of us who feel the call to pastoral leadership, there's this interesting dilemma among people who want to achieve and aspire to whatever it is that they aspire to, and how we put that alongside texts like we have today. The downward mobility we see in the texts we have this morning is something chosen. It's not the result of poor education or social location or wealth or a bad economy. It's about what it means to follow Jesus, according to Mark's text. Beginning in chapter 8, verse 34, Jesus talks to his disciples and laid out in a rather straightforward way what he expects of those who would be his disciples. When he says, "And he called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, 'If any wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will surely save it.'" Now, I owe much of what I'm about to say to the writing of Barbara Brown Taylor. a writer, author, pastor, who wrote a book called Gospel Medicine. Love the title of the book, Gospel Medicine. I decided I couldn't say it much better, so in a sense, in these next few minutes, I'm going to be preaching her sermon as if she were standing here. So imagine me, Barbara Brown Taylor. You can hardly blame the disciples for wanting to go with him. Teacher, they say to him, we want you to do whatever we ask of you. What they want, it turns out, are top-ranking cabinet positions. When the kingdom comes, they want to sit close to Jesus, as close as they can. And while this may be an example of gross ambition on their part, it may also be a case of profound faith. James and John absolutely believe that Jesus will reign. In spite of his dire predictions, in spite of the storm clouds on the horizon ahead of them, they are so sure of Jesus' final victory that they sign up to go with him. And this is not unreasonable, since they have been his chief assistants from the start. Along with Peter, they are Jesus' closest friends, the ones he takes with them when he leaves the others at home. So it is natural for them to want to stay near to Jesus, and they seem willing to do whatever it takes. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And although they don't know what he's saying, they don't hesitate. We are able. We are ready. Sign us up, they say in unison. And then Jesus tries one more time to tell them how things are. They seem to believe that the new world will be set up the same way the old world, only with new leadership in place. The bad guys at the head of the table will be removed, their chairs will be fumigated, and God's new crew will be seated. With Jesus in the number one position, and with the most loyal members of the campaign staff on either side of him. Once this change has been accomplished, then finally, at last, the good people will commence to redeem the world from top to bottom. The ultimate trickle-down effect. It doesn't work that way. Jesus tells them one more time. The new world is not remotely like the old one. It turns the old one upside down. The number ones are not the powerful ones having their pictures taken at the head table. They're the ones slipping in and out among the guests, refilling the wine glasses, and laying down clean silverware between courses. The great ones are not the dignitaries to the left and the right of the ruler. They are the slaves who are stirring the pots in the kitchen, testing the temperature of the soup so that it is neither too hot nor too cold for the honored guests. James and John want for Jesus to hurry up and become king of the world, but he has other things on his mind. Has everyone been served? Is all the food on the table? Does anyone need anything? Are there others that need to be at the table that aren't? Go invite them. For the human one came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. We may have heard this teaching so many times, it's all but lost on us. The end of the line is the place to be. The lowliest job is the one to covet. Those who serve are luckier than those in power, and lovers of God get less status, not more. It is incomprehensible in terms of the world in which we live. Things simply do not work that way. The only way to make any sense of this at all is to think of it as some sort of intermediate stage, like boot camp or like parole. Do your time as a servant with no whining and win good seats in the kingdom to come. It doesn't work that way, Jesus tells them one more time. He is not pretending to be a servant until the time comes when he whips off his disguise and climbs onto the throne. He is servant through and through. The good seats are not his to give. He does not even have one himself. Someone else is in charge of all that. Someone he is too shy to even name, whom it is his sole pleasure and purpose to serve. He is not in it for the reward. He is in it for the love of God, which promises him nothing but the opportunity to give himself away. The best seat he will get is one on this side of the grave, is a throne full of splinters, and where he is hung out on it to dry by the powers that be. It will not be James and John on either side of him, but two unnamed bandits on his left, on his right side. Thus endeth Barbara Brown Taylor. In preparation for the sermon, I came across a quote from Mark Twain that seems so appropriate this morning as I struggled with this text. He said, a bit wryly, "It's not what I don't understand in the Bible that bothers me. It's what I understand all too well." And it seems that from historical perspective, the church has also experienced the same thing. So we've constructed elaborate theology over the years to avoid the hard sayings of Jesus. It was for another time, another dispensation. We've reduced the Christian life to saying some words that ensure us to get to heaven when we die. Or we've developed a just war theology to avoid Jesus' clear teaching on the way of peace and nonviolence. Or we feel envious of those in positions of power, be it political or ecclesiological. Or deep within our own hearts, we really do believe that redemptive violence is the only workable solution to deal with evil in this world. Is it that we understand Jesus' words all too well and just don't want to go there? We do well to be honest with ourselves and with the church. As Walter Brueggemann says, the Old Testament scholar reflecting on the wonderful early Christian hymn that's found in Philippians 2, one that you know well. The great kenosis hymn, kenosis, the Greek word for emptying, what Christ did. It speaks of Christ's willingness to humble himself even though he is God. And I quote from Walter Brueggemann about Philippians 2, and he says, quote, "This passage is a thoroughly political image concerned with the willing surrender of power. It is the very things kings cannot do and remain kings. Thus, the entire royal self-understanding is refuted. The empty one who willingly surrendered power for obedience is the ultimately powerful one who can permit humanness where no one else has the authority to do so." End quote. This willing surrender of power, something, Brueggemann says, kings absolutely cannot do and never will do. But the one we call King of Kings and Lord of Lords does it voluntarily. And models for us the hard way, but the way of life and joy. Yes, this gospel text reminds us today that the way of Jesus is considerably more dissident and demanding than we'd like it to be. Jesus' first disciples didn't always get it, particularly in the Gospel of Luke. On the Gospel of Mark, if you read Luke, Luke's a little more gentle on the disciples. But we don't always get it either. Perhaps the point is not so much whether we get it or not, but that it gets us. And that the Christ continues to, as it were, get under our skin. And not just under our skin, but in our heads and our hearts and our minds and our pocketbooks and our family rooms and our bedrooms, talking to us, patiently teaching us. And we do well to notice when we see downward mobility and genuine acts of humble service among us. In a few minutes, we'll dedicate the little tree out here in honor of Lester Hunsberger. It's appropriate that this lectionary text fall in a day in which we're talking about service. Lester was a servant among us for so many years. There are parts of this facility that he knew better than anyone here, including probably our electrical systems, our heating systems, and more. And as caring people, Lena and Lester gave countless rides to Linda, to Wanda, and others, and faithfully visited Rachel Hedrick and others. They would tell us about fish on a regular basis and remind us that and keep that ministry in front of us as volunteers there. We remember, we miss Lester, but we're thankful for his service among us. And I'm proud in a humble way of the countless ways that you also serve. Many of those acts of service are done on a daily and weekly basis without fanfare, without headlines. You do it just because it's the Jesus way. So yes, while there is a demanding text in front of us, I offer you a word of grace. For as we meet Christ, be it here or wherever those encounters happen for you, hear this demanding but gentle teaching, his challenge to you to grow in humility, to grow in service, to grow in, yes, downward mobility, and offers you unconditional love and forgiveness on that journey, and the times when we get it, and the times when we don't. So this morning we ask the question, and I leave the question with you, that Jesus heard from his disciples as they ask him, James and John, they ask Jesus, what is it? Here's what we want you to do for us. So this morning, what we want you to do for us, Jesus, is to offer us grace as we hear your words and challenge. And we want for you to empower us to be your servants today, tomorrow, and for the rest of our lives, so that we may get just a glimpse of your kingdom coming on earth as it is in heaven. We'd want you to do that for us, Jesus. And now as our response, I invite you to take out your blue hymnal and turn to 307. This service anthem, "Will You Let Me Be Your Servant," as Craig and Martha come and lead us. 307.
If you're willing and able, I invite you to stand. And one quick reminder.